Being that we're approaching Purim, let's try to look at some of the ideas behind Purim and perhaps what we should be focusing on. The context, obviously, throughout history, the context is always relevant, but in an age of increasing anti-Semitism, international feeling, you know, against us, I mean, not that it isn't always there, but goes in waves or phases, and obviously we need to try to understand a bit better what lies behind these currents of response or human emotion, and what lies behind the historical reality, and perhaps it can lead to a focus on the work that we should be doing, at least the work of our consciousness. There isn't a better time than Purim to do that. Particularly relevant to us because Purim is the time of dealing with the spiritual world that's not openly manifest. Pesach is the time of celebrating the miraculous phase of our history, and Purim is the time of dealing with the hidden phases. As I'm sure you're well aware, the Megillah of Purim, it tells the story, it's got no revealed miracles, there are no divine revelation. The Megillah, as you know, does not contain any divine names explicitly. It's all what's called Hastir Panai, I shall hide my face on that day. So the whole theme of history hiding its underlying workings, that's really what Purim is. And of course in that area, in that darkness, is the potential for more, in a strange way, for more light. Because when things are clearly revealed, then you have very little free will, very little work, very little input that you can do. When things are not clearly revealed is when you can shine your light, when we can really make our contribution. The way the Zohar puts it is that you can only shine light in the darkness. No light is emitted or visible, let's say, except in a darkness. That's the expression of the Zohar. You have to really put off the lights to see a candle. And since our candle is very small, it needs to shine in a very intense darkness. So, let's see if we can follow this through. You know, we have a principle that the underlying spiritual world is always there, always being watched, as it were, but it's not always apparent. Beautiful reference to this, perhaps a classic reference, is it says that behold, he stands behind our wall. Actually, our tradition is that it means the Western Wall. That's what it says in Shir HaShirim. Mashgiach min ha-chalonos u-metzitz min ha-charakim. Beautiful poetic expression. It means that he peers through the windows and peeps through the cracks. Describing Hashem, as it were. Talking about God, about Hashem. That he watches, stands behind the wall, and he is peering through the windows and peeping through the cracks. Beautiful. One of the beautiful insights that you can feel there is that there are two ways of watching from behind a wall. You can watch through a window or you can peep through a crack. And the difference is that when he watches us through the windows are those times in history where he's overseeing our activities. That means he is, as it were, watching what we're doing, but we see him too. Because when someone looks at you from a window, they see you and you see them. But when somebody sees you peeping through a crack, then they see you, but you don't see them. Right? There are two phases of history. Those phases when he watches us through the windows, as it were, which means he sees what we're doing and we notice that he's around. That would be Pesach, for example. And then there's times when he peeps through the cracks, which means that he sees surely what's doing, but we don't see him. That would be Purim. So our job, of course, in case you hadn't noticed, is to work in the darkness. We don't see revelations and miracles. We see very difficult and dark scenario. We have problems with our own awareness, let alone those accusations and detractors from the outside. We ourselves are not sure. The Jewish people really are in such a desperately difficult situation right now in terms of our own attachment to our own values. At the moment, we don't really need too many enemies. We're doing a pretty good job ourselves. in terms of detachment from our source and from our historical source. It's almost miraculous that so many Jews in this generation have got so little idea about anything Jewish at all, about any concept, about any attachment, any genuine Jewish knowledge. Almost miraculous that in one generation we could have changed from a percentage of Jews who were all more or less attached to a generation in which you could argue that the majority, and there are places where the majority of Jews aren't even aware that it's an issue. Not just that they've detached themselves, but they aren't even aware that there is an issue at all. Right? That's an extreme position to be in, and of course that's where the work begins, really. Let's try and work it out. The many strange things going on in the Megillah and in the story. You know, I'm sure, I'm not going to recap the events of the Megillah. I'm sure you're familiar with the events, that there was a massive anti-Jewish decree. Haman had it in his power. He was one of the most powerful people who ever lived. He was one of the very few of the most, of the richest, literally richest and most powerful individuals who ever lived. He was second only to the king, King Ahasuerus, who personally ruled over the whole known world. 127 countries of the known settled world were really all the civilized world. There really wasn't anything beyond those borders. And in those 127 states or zones or countries, if you like, he had absolute power. And Haman had the executive role. And therefore he had it in his power to make a decree of destruction against all Jews on one day. Right? I don't think there's really been a time in history like that, or perhaps not subsequently, when all Jews on earth were in one jurisdiction. Because the meaning of that is that you could really, you know, if there's mass destruction of Jews that's planned or even perpetrated in one place, there's always some other place where at least somebody could hope to survive. But in that generation, it wasn't like that. That was a generation when all Jews on earth fell into one jurisdiction, which means that he was able to promulgate an order that meant that all the non-Jews in all those countries could rise up on one day and literally wipe out Jews and Judaism. Not talking about just a pogrom or just an anti-Semitic campaign. You're talking about the instantaneous end, and it's very significant in deeper terms that this was specifically to be done on one day. The concept of being done on one day, destroying all the Jews on earth on one day specifically, has a deep meaning. The meaning is to uproot the root itself. When a thing is done piecemeal, you're not really, you know, you're nibbling away, as it were. But the decree to uproot it on one day, the principle in the Gemara is that one day is one unit of time. One unit of time. En mechus zman leboi bayom. That means that in the same day is called no lack of time. It's no accident. You know that the Megillah, I'm sure you've noticed, you must have noticed, that the Megillah is a counterpoint. One of the polarities in the Megillah, one of the elements of extreme perfect balance, is that there is a retribution that's exacted, is exactly parallel to what was decreed to happen. In other words, that the Jews destroyed their enemies, right? In exact parallel, in exact same way that they were due. Again, Haman, for example, wanted to destroy Mordechai. Right? And again, the way he wanted to do it was also, I mean, on the face of it, let's just understand a bit more deeply. On the face of it, he hated Mordechai as a Jew, a representative of the Jews, and he wanted to destroy him. So he built a gallows, 50 amas high, which is enormous. 50 amas is about 25 meters, more than 20 meters high. That's a good few stories. It's a height of a significant building. And particularly chose that height. He wanted to hang Mordechai. And in the end, he was hanged himself on the same gallows. But the balance is perfect. I mean, the Medrash says that he even climbed up on the gallows himself to try it out. He even put his head in the noose to just get a feel of what it would look like. And the Medrash says that the angel Gabriel looked down and said, "Suits you." Because what was being set up was the potential for a counterpoised, right? That means that the final retribution or the final salvation of the Jews, if you like, was an exact balance, exact opposite to what was intended to be done. He was hanged on his own gallows. And not only that, but the deeper sources indicate that The reason that Haman wanted to hang him on a gallows 50 meters high means that he wanted to attack the 50th level. The 50th level is always a spiritual source. Mordechai represented, not actually in Kabbalistic terms, Mordechai represents the first midah, the first of the Kabbalistic energies, if you like, or first of the deeper levels, first meaning that which contains all of them. And the idea was to uproot the whole spiritual idea from its source. That means Hashem's, you know, Haman represents Amalek, which is really the concept of self-worship. That means we are all that, I'm all that, I'm all that there is. And therefore he wanted to attack him at that level of root. And on one day, that means, yeah, complete effort to uproot him from the source. And of course what happened was that he himself was uprooted from the source. You know that after they hanged Haman, they hanged his 10 sons. And you know that we have a very strange, you know, a strange custom. If you look in a Megillah, you'll see that all 10 sons, you know, a very interesting custom in the way the Megillah is written and the way that it's read. The way the 10 sons of Haman are written in the Megillah is all in one line. What you call, there are two ways that a, let's try and slowly, one thing at a time. The destruction of the 10 sons of Haman is called a song. It's called a song, a shir. There are a number of songs that are written in Tanakh. And one of them that's parallel is the destruction of the 31 kings of Canaan. When Joshua conquered the land, there were 31 kings, and they're also written when it's written properly on a proper parchment, they're written in a what's called Ariach al Gabel Levana, which means the way bricks are put together is that any bricklayers among you will know that bricks are never laid in columns. They're always laid where the one brick sits on the join of two lower ones in the previous row. That's what gives strength to a... But there are two ways you can write a song in Torah. One is like that, or you can write the words, either the words over the spaces, and the spaces over the words, or all the words over each other and all the spaces over each other. The way the sons of Haman are written, all the sons in one line, all on top of each other. The deeper sources indicate it means no escape. It means all in one dimension, that they can't... in their being destroyed, they're all, as it were, bonded together, caught together. We have a custom that when the Megillah is read, we read the names of all 10 of them in one breath. You've noticed that custom? In fact, the custom in most communities is that when you get to that point, the person who's reading stops, and everybody says all 10 names, that all the 10 sons, Pashandasa, and you say the names of the 10 sons, all in one breath. And then whoever's reading the Megillah goes over them all again in one breath. What's going on here? Why? Because it says in Halacha, the Gemara says, because they all died, all their breaths expired as one. They all hang together. They all died together. All hang together. What does that mean? And why is it a song in the first place? What is the song of, right? We're not a people who exact personal vengeance. Revenge, right, to sing when our enemies are destroyed. When there's song, when our enemies are destroyed, we sing because of the salvation that we experience and because of the spiritual balance that's reestablished in the world. We never focus on the destruction of the enemy. You know, it's quite unique about Judaism that we never ask for revenge, you know that? Even though we have suffered arguably more than any other people in history, simply because, not that others haven't suffered, others have suffered terribly, but we've been around a lot longer than everybody else and we've suffered continually. And despite that, we never ask for revenge. We do ask Hashem to take revenge. And occasionally we ask Him to take revenge and let us see it. But we never crave, it's a remarkable thing, we don't crave to take revenge ourselves, even though it says in Siddur Yesharim and other places that revenge is sweet as honey, or perhaps sweeter than honey. Because to do what was done to you in exactly the same way when you're able to do that is a very sweet thing. A very deep spiritual source, actually. The idea of nakam, of revenge. But we never ask for that ourselves. And to sing when they're destroyed, we sing not because they're destroyed, we sing because we are saved and because the spiritual accounting is corrected in the world. And therefore, when they destroyed those 10 sons, the song that's sung then is not only because of our salvation, but because it happened exactly the way they wanted to do it to us. It's no accident here. What the intention was to destroy all Jews on one day, that means uproot them in one instant from the source, and the 10 sons of Haman, which means he and his progeny, that means all of his 10 dimensions, as it were, they all die in one. Now, can you see the parallel here? And therefore, we express it in one breath, and we sing it as a song. It's written as a song. A song always means the completion of a circle. You know, in Torah, songs are always sung. The Gemara says that there are 10 songs to be sung in the world, and 9 have been sung, and the 10th will be the song of Mashiach, which is the final closing of the circle. The word shir in Hebrew, you know, we've studied together many times, shared together many times the idea that in Hebrew the words actually say what they mean. Not unlike other languages where the words are simply conventions. In Hebrew, the word for a song is a shir. Shir literally means a circle. In Hebrew, shir means a circle. Behema yotzes b'shir shelo. An animal goes out with a ring. It means like a nose ring. A shir is a circle. It's very interesting. The same word in Hebrew, which means song, means a circle. And also, furthermore, the same letters spell yashar, which means straight. The letters that spell shir, which mean a circle, are the same letters that spell yashar, which means straight. And that is a Kabbalistic reference to the... I know you're not interested in those deeper things, so I won't go into it in detail, but there's a notion that the world is based on a straight line and a circle. Two serpents, if you really want to know. A straight one and a circular one. The circular one has his tail in his mouth, and I'm an eye. I know you're much more interested in the halachic and mundane, so... But the point is that these are really two dimensions of the world. There's a straight line which goes from beginning to end. The word Bereishis spells Yashar, Aleph, Beis, Taf. Yashar, straight. The Jewish people are called Yashar, Kael, Yisrael. Means Yashar, the straight one of Hashem. Yeshurun means straight to the 50th. Yeshurun. Two names of the Jewish people, Yisrael and Yeshurun. Yisrael means Yashar, straight. Yeah, the straight ones of Hashem. And Yeshurun means straight to the 50th, which is again Hashem, the transcendent dimension. Bereishis, really, the beginning of the Torah, really spells the idea of Yashar, straight, from Aleph Beis to Taf, which means the beginning of movement to the end. That's the idea of the world, is to go straight and not deviate. But when you get to the end, you discover that it's the completion of a circle. Again, it needs a lot of discussion. But it's closing that circle, which is really what it really means, just to get a feel for it, means that the end point is really a revelation of what was intended in the beginning. What does it mean that when you end a journey, you arrive, that the destination is the point of departure? Because a spiritual journey means that the end of the journey, the destination, is nothing other than an expression of what you really wanted to achieve in the first place. What's called Seif Maaseh V'Machshava Tchila. Are we together? Isn't the end of a building exactly what the architect had in mind? Hasn't he arrived back at that point when the building has been built? And it's perfect expression of the plan, which is a perfect expression of the architect's concept. It means that at the end, what you have is the most perfect return to the... are we making some progress here? Or are we just going around in circles? A song means a celebration of having gotten back to the end point, which was the shortest route to the destination without any deviations, a perfect circle. And therefore, the bursting forth in song is the expression of having reached that revelation, which is the end point. When the Jews are redeemed from Egypt, and we go through the sea, and the enemy is destroyed in the sea, we sing the song, not for his destruction, but again for that revelation of the redemption that is a complete justification, vindication of all that happened, and a complete turnaround, which is the destruction of the destroyers themselves. In the Megillah, what happens is when Haman and his 10 sons are destroyed in one breath, right? Which means exactly the way that should have been the destruction of the Jews on one day, is that song being sung. And it's the song that's called Nekama, revenge. Incidentally, that's why, you know, the name of Hashem is expressed on Purim by what happens. It's not expressed explicitly, it's not mentioned in the Megillah. So the Gemara says that there are three ways that Hashem's name is joined. You know, there are three words that join together two names of Hashem. In the whole of Torah, Hashem's name is written twice. There are three times it's written on either side of a word. In other words, right, Ben Shnei Shemois, it says, three times you have in Torah the expression of two names with a word between. One of them is the Beis HaMikdash, Hashem. Hashem, that the Beis HaMikdash is built by Hashem's hands. There we have the Mikdash, Hashem, Kenan Yodecha. We have the Mikdash, Hashem, Mikdash Hashem, the sanctuary, the temple, phrased between two names. Another time we have it is Das, Kael Deus Hashem. Kael is the name of Hashem, Aleph and Lamed together, is the name of the primary expression of Hashem in the world. And Hashem, Yud Kei Vav Kei, is the full expression, moving from the one beginning of expression to the fullness of its expression. Oh, this needs a lot of discussion. You have in between those Das. Das means deep wisdom, understanding. That means in order to bring Hashem, as it were, into full expression in the world, you want to be a witness, as it were. You want to bring His presence into that which is experienced and recognized in the world, then you have to have intelligence. You have to have da'as Torah. You have to understand what Torah is. You have to have human intelligence, wisdom, clear objectivity, and the clear objective knowledge of Torah. Then those two names are built that way. And the third expression is Kael Nekamas Hashem. Very interesting thing. The same two words, Hashem, Kael and Hashem, are put together with the word revenge in between. Which means, again, long discussion, but basically what's being Nekama, Kael Nekamot Hashem, right? What really is being said here is that there are two alternative ways. Three ways, really. But let's focus on these two. These are two ways that the full name of Hashem can be expressed in the world. Either Kael Deus Hashem, you can build that progression in the world from understanding and from knowing and from wisdom, spiritual wisdom. Or Kael Nekamas Hashem, from revenge. We don't mean vengeance on a personal level. On the contrary, we're not interested in that. But we mean the revenge of Hashem's honor. You know, when King David died, on his deathbed, his dying words to his king, to his son Shlomo HaMelech, he gives him his final will, right, as the expression of the ultimate king, who is the messianic figure. And in his last words, he says, and make sure you kill Shimi ben Gera, make sure you bring him down to his grave in blood, right, because he cursed me. Shimi ben Gera had cursed David and incurred a death sentence, and David had sworn not to kill him. But since justice required, the din of the Torah required that he were killed, David saw to it that revenge was taken and he was killed. If there's one time in a person's life he's not thinking about vengeance on his enemies, it has to be when he's dying. If there's one time in your life you'd feel vulnerable, that's not exactly the kind of thing you'd think about, it would be that. And in his dying words, David, you have to understand here, there's no sense of personal vengeance. You're talking about David HaMelech, you're talking about Torah, you're talking about Mashiach, you're talking really about the vengeance that is the correcting of a spiritual account on Hashem's account. Right? And the Gemara has many examples of this where the final justice in the world will not just be that the balance is redressed, but it will be exactly redressed. That means every event and every detail, every slight deviation from the righteous path that was followed throughout history will be corrected in exactly the way that it was destroyed. Not in approximate or equivalent fashion, but exactly the same way. In fact, that in the deep Kabbalistic sources is regarded as humorous. The last thing you might think about as being funny is revenge. But it says, Yoshev b'shamayim yishchak, Hashem, who sits in the higher world, is looking down and laughing. Because what's happening on earth is that everybody who makes more destruction and more damage and more spiritual evil in the world is actually building its own correction in exactly the same way. I mean, there's no shortage of sources for this. Pharaoh, for example, Paro. We spoke about Purim and Pesach, right? Well, if you just take those two examples. On Pesach, when the Jewish people are being redeemed from Egypt, Pharaoh himself, Paro, who is the ultimate destroyer of the Jewish people, who tries to wipe them out, he's sitting on his throne. On his knees is the little baby Moshe Rabbeinu, yeah, Moses. He's sitting on his knee, being brought up in the palace of Pharaoh. Here Pharaoh is busy issuing orders for the destruction of the Jewish people, killing all Jewish males by throwing them into the Nile, so that the Redeemer will not survive. So here he is making an absolutely watertight plan for destruction of the Jews, from whom will come this Redeemer, killing all of them to make sure he doesn't miss the one is the Redeemer. And while he's doing all this, he on his knee is raising the very child. That is very funny. It's spiritually funny. It's not funny in human terms. People are being destroyed here. But in spiritual ultimate terms, there's a deep humor here. And of course, in Purim, that's exactly what's happening. Haman is making a plan to destroy all Jews on one day, taking on no less than Hashem himself. And ultimately what happens is he builds his own, he hangs himself on his own, that means in detail, he and his sons in one breath, exactly what he wanted to do to us is exactly what he's really building for himself, right? It's part of the mask and the hilarity of Purim too, right? Is that behind this mask is a reality that will be unmasked and revealed. This is what's happening. That's why we have a custom on Purim, to wear masks, disguises, we dress up like non-Jews. We dress up like them and look like them. There's a masked world here in very deep preparation for the turnabout, for the turnaround. That's what's going on. And this nekama, this revenge, is a redressing of the balance in every detail. That's what it is. And therefore, there are sources that indicate that Purim is the one day a year when this can be balanced, and we say, Kael Nekamas Hashem. And that's why it's a one day a year when you don't need das. Kael Deus Hashem. You can build that reality in the world by spiritual wisdom. There's one day a year you can build that reality by being totally unaware. The law of being drunk on Purim, being drunk means not having any intelligence at all, not having any intellect at all, right? You have to get so drunk on Purim that you can't tell the difference between Baruch Mordechai and Ar Haman. You can't tell the difference between who's the ultimate good and the ultimate evil. And if you can't, so then those who can't get, those whose drunkenness would not lead to the desired spiritual refinement and elevation in fulfillment of this law, such people should have very little to drink and go to sleep. Because by going to sleep, you fulfill the requirement of not knowing the difference. So you can fulfill it either by alcohol, by drunkenness, or by literal unconsciousness. But the point is that you don't need the consciousness on the day when the kama is being expressed. Because on that day when the spiritual balance, the accounting, is being taken care of, when all the accounts are being balanced, when all the evils being redressed in exactly the right way, that you finally see in a phase of history how that process of evil that was designed to destroy us actually obliterates itself. So on that day is one day when that's happening. And of course it's a very high, very high day. It's in one way it's higher than Yom Kippur. That's what's going on. So let's plumb a little bit more deeply. Let's descend a little bit more deeply into this idea. I mean, it's all connected, the one of Haman's sons. I mean, where did he get a beam 50 meters high? You don't get trees like that. You don't get trees like that. 50 meters, 20 meter, 25 meter tree. He had a plank, a board, a beam. It was a beam from the ark, from Noah's ark. Where did he get this central beam from the ark? And why was he so fussy it should be that one? It says Haman had a son who was an ambassador in Ararat, in the country where the ark had come to rest, and his son had it supplied, and it was shipped, sent to where Haman was, and it's all deeply connected. It was his son who provided it. It was from the ark, which is the salvation of the world, of course, no less than that. That means that on which humanity had ridden above the waves of its own destruction, as it were. That means all humankind comes from there. Well, you see, what Haman's looking for is a cosmic statement here. He's not looking for one particular Jew whom he didn't like. He wants to wipe out Jews and their source and what they represent all the way back to their first vestige of mention in human history. That's what he's looking for. And of course, that very process in the world is its ultimate builds and provides its own destruction. But let's just plumb a little bit more deeply into what intervenes between these points, between this massive Jewish anti-Semitic destructive force in the world and its final playing out in history, which we haven't experienced yet. The force that moves that is called Amalek. Right? So let's spend a few minutes this evening and study that energy. Amalek is that nation descended from Esav, from Esau, who's the ultimate character who states that he is all that counts. He made himself a god, as it were. Right? Ultimate self-worship. Who's, again, counterpoised against Yaakov, whose all existence, as it were, on earth is especially Amalek, that particular grandson of Esav, whose whole reason for existence is destroying Jews. There are other nations who are anti-Semitic who want to destroy Jews along the way, right? Or to get to their objectives, let's say. They wish to destroy Jews. But there's one nation on earth which lives only to kill Jews. That means its nature, even suicidally, if necessary. Right? Its theme, its reason for the reason it's prepared. What is the reason that a nation would throw itself suicidally to attack another nation? When the Jews moved through the desert and Amalek was prepared to throw itself into a hopeless suicidal attack, what is the concept, what logic could there possibly be between wanting to kill yourself or being prepared to die in order to kill someone else? There's only one possible logic there, and that is that their death is your life. Somebody whose life is what it is, and to get there they need to kill you. So they'll kill you to get there, but they're not going to die to do that, because then what's left? The only person who would consider dying to get where he wants to is where what he wants to get to is your death, and it doesn't matter if he lives or dies. His existence lies in your dying. And therefore, the notion of Amalek, Ratzolak HaKohen says that Amalek has no redeeming spiritual spark. That means we have a notion that even the worst evils on earth have a spark of holiness, as it were, that can be extracted from them. And the final revelation will be exactly that. That means the redeeming of that Kedush, what they brought to the world, that was constructive. Amalek has none at all. The only spark that he has lies in his own self-annihilation. That means the only thing that he brings to the world is the evidence that ultimate evil destroys itself. And in being annihilated, finally, that will be demonstrated. But there's nothing positive that comes out of it. And that's because he sets himself up against us as being defined by our death and annihilation. It's all he wants in the world. He doesn't want to kill us to do what he wants to do. He wants to kill us because that is his life. Right? It's that absolute concentration of evil that's called Amalek. And what is this? You have to understand that these things are spiritual things. It's not just that there happens to be a nation. There's nothing like that in Torah. There happens to be a nation that sociologically, psychologically, culturally, you know, historically, they don't like us. And they happen to have a particularly bitter hatred. Things don't work that way. Amalek is a nation on earth that represents a spiritual energy. The spiritual energy, the thing that he represents in the world, the spiritual force, the concept that he represents, is exactly opposite to that which we represent. Let's think about it for a moment. What are the Jewish people supposed to represent? We are supposed to be nothing other than evidence that Hashem is in the world. Again, let's understand carefully. Hashem, God, does not reveal himself openly. Right? Doesn't reveal himself openly. The playing out of history involves his being hidden. If there's one message of the Megillah, that's what it is. Why was her name Esther? Because Hastir Astir Ponnoi Boyon, I will hide my face, sure, I'll surely hide my face on that day. Means Hashem's guarantees tells her I'm going to hide my face. Peeping between the cracks, but you don't see him through the windows, hiding his face. Our job is to show that he's here when it's not obvious. Atem Edai, why did we stand at Sinai? We stood at Sinai to become witnesses. Hashem says, Atem Edai, you my witnesses. The function of a witness is to bring into revelation, is to bring into expression that which you can't see. You don't need a witness if you see a thing. If an event happens here, and I see this event happening, I don't need a witness. I need a witness to bring into expression. The witness has to... There's a very strange law in the laws of evidence. You know, if a... Give you a halakhic example of this. You know, if a Jew is on trial for blasphemy, what we call... Because Hashem, blessing Hashem. I mean, we mean the opposite, right? Cursing. If somebody cursed, it's very hard to say the words, but if somebody would properly, according to Torah definition, would curse the Creator, so that's a capital crime. Now, how is his trial conducted? So the witnesses who heard it have to testify before the judges, or they're based in what they heard. But they're not allowed to say that they heard him say such and such. They have to say it. They have to give testimony. You know how it goes in a Beis Din when this occurs? They clear the court. The Beis Din sits and listens. The witnesses have to come forward and say what they heard. Not say that they heard such and such. They have to say what they heard, and the judges have to tear their clothing. The Dayanim have to tear their clothing, right, to hear Hashem's name cursed like that. But there's no other way, because testimony means bringing into court the event. You can't bring a murder into court. Right? So you testify. But in this case, where it can be, they have to recreate. They're not like, are you with me? Why don't they simply come to court and say, we heard him curse? They don't do that. They have to come and say, he said, and then they have to say. Because the idea of a witness is that he brings into, the testimony is, that he recreates in the court, as it were, the event itself. Atem Edai means that you, Jewish people, on your shoulders, I ride in the world. If you don't witness it, I'm not present. The people of the earth have to see that I'm around because you make it apparent. That's what Jews are supposed to be doing. What do you think you're saying when you say Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad? You're saying that all is one, He is everything that there is, and you have to say it because it's not apparent. In fact, in Shema, the Ayin of the Shema and the Dalet of Echad, put those words together, it spells Eid, means witness. That's what you're doing when you're saying Shema, you're giving evidence that Hashem is one. Of course, before you can do the aid, you have to know it yourself, which is if you take ayin and dalet, you reverse them, it spells da, which means no. A witness. Yeah, first he has to know, personal experience, and then he has to aid, he has to say. It's no accident that the two letters form both those words. That's what you mean when you say Shema. So you have to be my witnesses. And that force that opposes that in the world is Amalek. Amalek comes along and says, what spiritual reality? Excuse me, where? Well, what creator? Where? We don't see it. They are the gap between the presence and the knowledge. The presence of that knowledge and its absence. That's exactly what Amalek is. Amalek, if you add up the numbers, the numerical equivalent of the word, Amalek, it spells Sofek, doubt. Amalek is Sofek, doubt. Amalek says, well, maybe yes, maybe not, but it's irrelevant. That's what they say. And Jews live and, if necessary, die to say that it's not irrelevant. It's very relevant. I am the living testimony. I'm here. That's what I am. This is all that I am. And Amalek brushes it aside, and if necessary, he'll kill you, and if necessary, prepare to die doing so. And the reason is because there's nothing more important. That's the project that the world is set up to express. The project of the world's history is to express that Yeah, that we are here to testify and bring into existence his existence, even though it's not obvious and apparent. And the force that opposes that in the world is Amalek. Let's try and study this a bit more deeply. I mean, there's nothing more important than this. This is what we're supposed to be doing as Jews. The Gemara says like this. Let's just get it and put it in context. See how deep these things are. The Gemara says, where do you see Haman's name in the Torah? Now that itself is a strange question. Haman min haTorah minayin. Where do you see Haman's name in the Torah? That itself is a very strange question. Because Haman lived in the post-prophetic era, more or less. In other words, talking about the end of scriptural history. And the whole festival of Purim is a rabbinic institution. Right? And mitzvahs that the rabbis... The mitzvahs that the rabbis, let's say, phrased or enumerated. And yet the Megillah is asking, the Gemara is asking, where do you find Haman's name? It's a late phase in history. Where do you find his name mentioned in the Torah? And not only that, but the answer is, you find his name in the Torah in the very beginning of creation. Where? In the question, Hamin Ha'etz, which means, when Hashem arrived in the garden, after Adam had eaten from the forbidden tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And Hashem arrives in the garden, Hashem says, Hamin Ha'etz Asher Tzivisicha, did you eat from the fruit of the tree which I commanded you not to eat? The word Hamin in Hebrew means, doesn't even mean anything. All it means is the question. You can't even translate it. Hamin, if you translate it literally, means did from. It's the way you simply introduce the question. Did you eat from the fruit of the tree? The way you introduce that question is the name Haman. Hamin is spelled exactly the same as the name Haman. What's being said here? The name Haman, that archetypal figure who represents Amalek, right, who give anything to destroy all Jews on earth and very nearly managed, his name is written in the question that Hashem asks man, did you eat from the... What is going on? First of all, it's incredible to note, that his name is mentioned right in the very beginning of human experience. I mean, that means it's something, this is not peripheral or just a small detail. Back in the first of human experiences, the first human expression and failure, right, is followed up by Hashem arriving in the world and saying, did you eat? And if you think about it for a moment, what kind of question is that? God himself asking, did you eat? He doesn't know. And if you note, the whole conversation goes that way. He arrives in the garden and the first thing he says, Ayeka, where are you? Where are you? Adam's hiding. So Hashem arrives and he says, Ayeka, where are you? You see, Adam was clothed before in light. His skin was made out of light. What's called kosnos or, aleph vav resh. And after the sin, he became clothed in ayin vav resh. You know, when an aleph becomes an ayin in Hebrew, it means it takes on a physicality. Aleph is a silent letter of spirituality. Ayin in Hebrew is an expressed. Ayin is a guttural letter. It's not a silent letter. He was first clothed in light, aleph vav resh. And after the sin, he became clothed in ayin vav resh, skin. Actually, the Kabbalistic sources said it was the skin of the snake, but that's another. Doesn't matter, it's another point. Point is that he became clothed in or. So or with an aleph changes to or with an ayin. Actually, the word or with an ayin in Hebrew, ayin vav resh, actually spells skin, but also spells blindness. Iver in Hebrew means not to see. Or means light is the medium of sight, what you do see. You saw the inside. The outside and inside were all one. And then he broke the world into a situation where he now became clothed in ayin vav resh, hide. It hides, iver, to hide, to be blind. Even in English we call this a hide. Where did they get that idea? Where did the English expression decide that a skin is a hide? Because it hides the inner content, that's what it is. So he's hiding. He's the world has become a hidden place. He himself thinks he can hide. And he hides under the trees. You see, the tree that he ate from, we are taught to think that it's the tree of the knowledge of evil. But if you look very carefully, it says, Eitz Hadas Tov V'ra. The tree that he was forbidden to eat from is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Knowledge technically in Hebrew means combination. Das means combination. To know something really means to bond with that information to the point that the facts become one with you. Marriage is called das, right? The intimacy of marriage is called das. It means bonding into oneness. To know a thing intimately means to be one with it. That tree is called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It means good and bad become one. What is the meaning of good and bad becoming one? It means confusion. This is where doubt enters the world. It was not the tree of evil. Had it been called the tree of evil or the tree of knowledge of evil, then eating from that tree would have left, It would have been so offensive and so obviously evil, no one would have gone near it. But it's not like that. It's the tree of the combining of good and evil. When you eat from that tree, you become confused. That's what happens. You don't become bad, you become confused. Doubt enters your mind. You can't see things clearly. What could be a better illustration than the fact that Adam eats from the fruit of that tree and then he starts hiding from the one whom he knows can see through the trees? Talk about confusion. He himself speaks to Hashem. He has a face-to-face conversation. He knows who exactly Hashem is. He himself is cosmic in his greatness. A few moments later, after he's eaten from the fruit of the tree, he starts hiding under the trees. He's trying to fool himself into thinking that you can hide from the one who sees through the trees. He's become completely confused. And the response, of course, is Hashem arrives in the garden and says, "Where are you? I can't see you." That's how you want to set up the rules? You want to set up the rules? I'm your shadow. Hashem tzilcha al yadi minech. Hashem is your shadow. You want to set up the world in such a way that you think I can't see you? So then I come and I say, "Where are you?" The word ayeka in Hebrew, which means "where are you," is the same as echa, which means the dirge of lamentations, of mourning. So Adam crawls out from under the bushes, right, knowing now he's dealing with Hashem, who now is dealing with him from a distance, no longer in proximity. He's now at a distance, as if he doesn't know what's happening. He's not looking through the window anymore. He's gone behind the wall now. He's looking through the cracks. So Adam arrives and Hashem says, "Did you eat? Hamin ha'etz asher? Did you eat?" And his question, "I don't know. Did you or didn't you? I don't see clearly. I'm not manifest in history." That question, "Did you," is Haman. And that's where he's born. Haman's born in the world at the point of human confusion. Not just human confusion, but apparent divine non-existence. I mean, Hashem himself speaks as if he does not know what's happening. And he says, "Hamin," which means, if there ever was an expression of a threat to divine omniscience, that Hashem knows everything, it's when he himself arrives and says, "Did you eat? I myself lack a knowledge." That is called the most objective expression of Hashem's distance from the world, that he does not see and know. And that's Haman. Haman represents that force on earth which keeps Hashem out. The force of doubt, the force of confusion, that the world's an accidental place. The whole thing is an accident. It was a big bang that happened because of certain chemical forces, and human beings are just accidental versions of chimpanzees or gorillas. And the whole thing's just an accident. Molecules bumping into each other by accident, and the whole thing's just chaos. Like much of modern thinking is. That's Amalek. That's exactly what Amalek is. And he's born by Adam partaking of that fruit of confusion and allowing that doubt to enter the world. And of course, that's the cosmic battle. The battle between Amalek and us is not just the battle between a, you know, sociologically orientated, you know, a nation that happens to be anti-Semitic. That's not the concept. The concept is that there's a force represented on earth. The point of the spear, if you like, is Amalek. But many, many follow suit, follow behind him. Some less committed, some more committed. But the battle is to show that we don't exist. That means to destroy us. And of course, the higher battle between our spiritual sources is to wipe out that notion that Hashem is in the world even though you don't see him. Our battle is to show that he's here even though you don't see him. And their battle is to show that he's not here because you don't see him. That's what the battle is. There's no greater battle than that. And of course, just like he's prepared to die to prove that, we should be prepared to do so too. Of course, if we know how to live for it, we don't have to die for it. But he has a remarkable degree of commitment in this battle. And you notice that some of those who are most potent enemies have that immense commitment. I mean, some of them are prepared to die, and some of them consider it a great privilege to die to kill us. You know, they mean business with their commitment. So you have here a battle ranged between those forces who mean to destroy us, even if it costs them their lives, and a majority of the Jewish people at present who don't even know that that's an issue. Talk about an unfair battle. That means they're not ranged, you know, the battle lines are drawn. Here you have an enemy that is single-mindedly focused on destroying us. That's what he's doing throughout history. And you've got now the Jewish people who are wandering around in circles, not even knowing that there's a battle going on. That's where we're holding now. That's the degree of the darkness. And of course, those who have some chance of knowing what's going on, even if you feel very inadequate yourself, but when the battle's being lost, then even those who wouldn't have to be out there on the battlefield, even those who would ordinarily be, you know, sent home on leave. Unfortunately, there's only walking wounded right now. Anybody else. And therefore, we all, you like it or not, you're on the battlefield. And the nature of the battle is to prove, to give evidence, to speak out the evidence that there's something else here. even though it's not immediately apparent. That's what our job is, to close that gap. Adam made the mistake because he opened the gap. He wanted to make a gap in the world. He thought he could achieve more by having more of a gap. Is he more free will? No. Let's try to understand that gap, and perhaps that will bring us to a point where we can close the circle. Why did he open that gap? Why did he eat that fruit and introduce the Hamina Eitz Haman into the world? So Tzadik explains, what Adam wanted to do was, he felt that he had so little work to do that could honor Hashem. Hashem only asked him to do one thing, not eat the fruit of a certain tree. So Adam said, you mean that's all you want from me? You created me with this cosmic power, amazing, you know, almost divine level of power. You want me to sit here and not do something? How will I, what am I going to build for you? What? How can I show my love for you if you don't give me a bigger challenge than that? And Hashem said, there's one challenge in this that you're not appreciating. What I want here is your ego. I want you to give back your self-expression. I want you to give back to me your ability to prove who you are. That's what Hashem was looking for. I want you yourself, your ego, the point of essence, which is your freedom. What is that freedom? Your freedom is your freedom to express yourself as you, or to give it back and show that there's nothing in the world besides me. And that's where he went wrong. The point of origin, that means you have to understand the very center of the battle was, not that he craved the fruit of a certain tree. On the contrary, he had no craving at all. The only thing he craved was being close to Hashem. He had no negativity within him, like we do today. All he wanted to do was, and that was the battle. The battle was, take your free will and give it back. Take that ego that seeks to express itself and prove that you are something, as it were, separate from me, that you are a source unto yourself, and give it back to me. That was too difficult a battle. And that's the battle. Amalek's battle is to say, no, I'm here. I'm a someone. I'm here to express myself in the world. Rav Tzadok actually goes so far as to show that that is what the non-Jewish nations are. They are here to express themselves and build the world. And our job is to desist from building the world and show that it's Hashem. Do you know what Shabbos is? The definition of a Jew is one who keeps Shabbos. It's virtually synonymous with being Jewish. Shabbos means you take your hands off the world and you say, this is not me, it's you. That's what Shabbos is. Shabbos means that Hashem manifests and you don't. What you not do on Shabbos, you do not do the creative activities that build the world. Says Rav Tzadok, what you're doing is admitting the non-existence of your own ego. When you move through the week and you build the world, you manifest mastery over the world, you build it, you create it, you keep it going. So what you're doing is you're expressing yourself and your power in the world. But there's one day a week, which is Shabbos, which you say, it's all you, Hashem, it's not me. That's why a non-Jew is not allowed to keep Shabbos. A non-Jew is not allowed to keep Shabbos. Because his essence in the world is to build the world. What a non-Jew is here for is to build the world and make it beautiful and subdue it and control it and make it a perfect substrate for spirituality. And what we're supposed to do is harmonize with them and show that it is all spiritual. That's what we're supposed to be doing. And therefore, we forfeit our lives if we work on Shabbos, and a non-Jew forfeits his life if he stops working on Shabbos. That's the harmony. And that's the battle, and that's where he went wrong. And therefore, the conquest of this battle, really, is not to go out and beat Amalek on the battlefield or beat him in the place, the real place to beat Amalek is to beat that essence, that level of doubt, that gap in the mind, in the consciousness. It's your own Amalek that's the problem. The one on the outside will disappear if you conquer the one that's inside. The one that's inside says, well, it's all doubtful, and maybe yes, and maybe not, but attracts you towards that world. You see that world, you admire it, all you want is what they want. Then Amalek in the external world, then he has his power. The battle is not to get out there in the battlefield. The battle is fought inwardly, just like Adam Arishan. Adam's battle was an inward battle, and he made his own personal mistake. That's what gives rise to Amalek in the world. And of course, that's where the battle has to be won. It has to be to live in a Purim world, a world where the truth is not apparent, where all you see is darkness. There's no divine revelation, there's no miracles. All there is doubt and gap and distance in the world. Where those who live a spiritual way of life are mocked and derided and belittled and scorned. And those who engage physicality are the ones who respect and admire. And that's where the world tells you that it is. And that's the battle. The battle is to reassert that primacy of the spiritual within the neshama, within consciousness. It's not easy at all. It has to be done against all the seeming evidence of a world that expresses the opposite. But it's in that private place in the mind, it's back in that garden, as it were, that place among the trees, right? Such as it is, in one's own consciousness, where this battle has to be fought, What is the real meaning here? What will be the end here? What am I going to become? And it's in closing the gap in there. It's in rebuilding that consciousness and closing that gap. And the only way to close the gap of doubt is in the character-building exercise of destroying ego. Because as soon as you have to assert who you are, you've lost the battle. It doesn't mean you don't do things in the world, or you don't assert your personality or your character in the world. We're not talking about annulling those things. We're talking about annulling the childish vested interest of ego. That's what it has to be. Once that happens, a pure objective clarity. And then the battle is, now that that clarity has been attained, let's work it out. Let's study the facts and study. Learn Torah and map it to its counterpart of existence in the world. And as that process continues and as inner clarity is developed, so the personal inner Amalek is being destroyed. As the doubts get less and the clarity grows, that gap is closed in the world. And of course, in one's own inner dimension, when that gap is closed, then the corresponding Hashem Tzilcha, that one, that other side of the chasm where he responds as if he doesn't know, he stops playing that game too. The more you start having a more personal, intimate relationship, the more you start feeling it and knowing it, the more you get that response, because that's the way it works. And of course, when the gap is entirely closed, that's what we call Mashiach. First, it happens inwardly. If enough of us do that, it will happen outwardly as well. And the final point where the straight line reaches its destination and then reveals that it has come back to its point of origin, where that song will be sung, is that element of nekama, that element where what will be seen in the external world is that all the destructive elements and all the meaningless and chaotic elements of pain, that they all implode, they all self-destruct. That's the work of Purim. The method, of course, is to fulfill the mitzvahs. Let's not forget that. It's not just have ideas on Purim. There's things that have to be done. Drinking is, part of it. No question, but the more important things, the four mitzvahs, you have the meal on Purim, Purim meal in the afternoon, you have the Megillah morning and night, to look up the details so you do it right, you send gifts to friends, at least two gifts to one friend, men to men, women to women, and you give charity, at least a significant amount of charity to at least two people. The gifts is the concept of love between us, and making a personal bond. That's why men give to men and women to women, because it is the idea of a personal bond. Charity you could give to men or women, because it's a concept of charity. But it's that forming of a bond between us, which is built by these mitzvahs. Just like the Torah was originally accepted by our manifesting as one, Purim also a time of tremendous bonding of unity of the Jewish people. The real bonding of unity means that we all have the same goal. Doesn't mean we have to look the same, we have the same customs. It means we have the same goal. And that goal is lighting the darkness of doubt in the world. By being the ones who are the witnesses, Atem Eidah, we have to bring that into the world. Therefore, the resolution has to be that we bring this to the front of the agenda. This Purim is a time for not only fulfilling the mitzvahs and not only becoming unconscious, but perhaps before that unconsciousness sets in, just a moment or two of genuine consciousness of what it is that we're trying to build. What we're trying to do is kill that gap. Kill that gap, close that gap, eliminate that doubt from the world. And that, it's a shame if we get a little bit of that right. Not too much can be expected from us, in our situation. But if we do the little bit that we can hope to change that response that we experience in this phase of history, which is only eyes peering through the cracks, into that shining face looking through the windows.